Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a major story and issue underlying the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how Washington is failing us and who is to blame, with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report and a former White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We will discuss the radical takeover of the Republican Party and the flagrant fealty the Republican right has to the millionaires and billionaires, while on the left, there is an obvious lack of a countervailing force to tip the balance just a little in favor of the vast majority of the American people. Then we'll explore further why the country's politics have moved inexorably to the right, with Salvatore Babonis, who is a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We'll discuss his article at Truthout, There Is No American Left, and try to determine what can be done to revive the political left in America so that the government represents the 99%, not just the 1%. And joining us now from Sydney, Australia, is Salvatore Babonis, who is a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He has an article at Truthout called There Is No American Left. Welcome to Background Briefing, Salvatore Babonis.
Oh, thank you, Ian, for having me on the show.
And why is there no American left to your mind? Because a lot of people that listen to this network I'm on and this program consider themselves American leftists, and to the extent that they somewhat live in an echo chamber, just like the people on the right listen to Fox News, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be irritated to hear that there is no American left.
Right. Well, I guess the first thing to say is there is an American left. A full title for the article would have been "There Is No Organized Political Left Among American Major Political Parties." So there are the Greens, there are the Socialists, there are many independent sources like Truthout, which is the website on which you found my article. There certainly are many leftists and progressives in America. It's just that they don't, I think, have a voice at the national political level.
Is there is it to do with our political system? It's a winner-take-all system. We don't have viable third parties. We don't have a proportional voting like they have in Australia, for example, and we don't have compulsory voting like they have in Australia.
Right. Well, I mean, a lot of people have written about that, and a lot of eminent social scientists have tackled this question of, you know, why is there no socialist party in America, or why is there no labor party in America? You know, that's competitive at the national level. It's a very difficult question to answer, and I don't think there's any one simple answer to the question. But a lot of it has to do, I think, with the role of money in American politics and the shift in the political landscape over the past 40 years. I mean, America was not a standout country by international standards in the 1960s and 1970s. You know, America had near universal health care by the early 1970s. America was one of the first countries in the world to put in serious environmental regulation. America had a very equal income distribution in the 1960s and early 1970s. I mean, when I was born in 1969, America had a 70% top tax bracket. You know, that's unimaginable today. But for, you know, at the time, America was not particularly a right wing or a highly conservative country. We tend to think of America as being a conservative, individualistic place that looks back to the 18th century founding fathers. But that's not really our heritage. That's a heritage that's been manufactured for us over the past 40 years.
Well, it seems to me, Salvatore Babonis, that a key event took place in 1972 with the memo that was written by later Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, who wrote the memo to his neighbor, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he was appalled, as a number of American conservatives were, by the anti-war movement and what happened. And one of the paradoxes of recent American politics is how those Americans who didn't participate in the anti-war movement, those that were appalled by it on campuses, end up having inordinate influence in America. Mitt Romney, who ran for president, was one of them. Half of the Supreme Court are also among them. So Lewis Powell wrote this memo that basically invited corporate America to get involved in American politics and to create right-wing think tanks and to stop the idea that these long-haired hippies are going to take over the United States. And conversely, what happened was on the left, this powerful movement, the minute that Nixon ended the war, the movement just disappeared and went away.
Yeah, the Powell memo is a famous memoir of our the American left, and I think it's something everybody should read, because the Powell memo just lays out in detail the strategy that you have that you've laid out and that has been followed by the American right ever since. But I'm an American, but I live in Australia, and so it's taught me to take a comparative perspective to things. Other countries have their billionaires who attempt to influence politics. You yourself are probably very aware that in Australia, Australian politics is dominated by, or the Australian media is dominated by Rupert Murdoch, just as Fox News is in the United States. Australian politics is dominated by large mining companies. And yet in Australia, the minimum wage is over $16 an hour. Everybody gets paid vacation time. Everyone gets paid sick days. University education is not free, but you pay for it. Everyone has low-interest government loans for their university education on easy terms. Universal health care. So, I think it's a mistake to look at specific events in U.S. history and say, well, because they had this campaign, it was unavoidable. After all, other rich people in other countries had similar campaigns. They just haven't been as successful. I think what we have to ask is, why has this anti-democratic campaign been successful in the United States when it's not been so successful in Europe or Australia or some other parts of the world?
Well, then that raises the question of why is America not a social democracy? And that's always been a paradox to me, that it was, after all, the U.S. that created the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II and brought about social democracies in Germany and Japan, but denied their own people the very things that have made Europe strong and Japan strong.
Oh, sure, but it was a very close run. So in 1948, just before the National Health Service was founded in the United Kingdom, just before the first country to go into full socialized government-provided health care did it, Harry Truman, the president of the United States, proposed fully nationalized health care for the United States. Now, he lost in the Senate with resistance from the American Medical Association and from Southern Democratic senators, but we were almost there. Right? And we got something close. We didn't get universal health insurance in 1948, but by 1970, the vast majority of Americans were covered by either employer-provided health insurance or by government plans. So I think it's a mistake. I mean, today America is not a social democracy, but America in 1970 had roughly as much social democracy as any Western European country had at the same time. It's just that they kept improving while we perhaps turned the other way. And I think a lot of the answer to that, a lot of the reason America has been unique in the last 40 years really has to do with the relationship between race and poverty in America. In America, there's no way to separate the idea of poverty from race, from the black-white relations, from Anglo-Latino relations, from American, Native American relations. All of these are tied up with this problem. And so we haven't had the same extension of benefits to all citizens in the way that countries that don't have the same heritage of race have had an increase or a consolidation of their social democracies over the past 40 years.
In other words, America was a social democracy during the Harriet and Ozzie halcyon days of the nuclear family, when blacks and Latinos were invisible. But since the 1970s, as they become more and more visible, social democracy has waned.
Right. Well, I think we were as much a social democracy as they were. I mean, remember, in Australia in the 1960s, Aboriginal Australians weren't even citizens. Other countries had their problems just as we did in the 1960s. But I think the key moment is not so much the Powell memo of 1972. The key moment is really the Democratic National Convention in 1968, in which there was rioting in the street. There was rioting on the convention floor. The police were, arresting demonstrators. The police were, a security guard punched,
Senator Jacob Javits, I believe. Yeah.
So that moment in America, I think, was the pivotal moment when the Democratic Party, instead of continuing to move forward and becoming a social democrat, a labor-type party. After 1968, the U.S. Democratic Party became much more centrist, much less willing to alienate people. The U.S. Democratic Party in 1964 and again in 1968 seated the white racist delegates from the South instead of seating the popular black Democratic representatives from the South. You know, this was really, I think, the watershed moment for America when civil rights and social democracy reached its high water mark. And then there simply wasn't enough support, especially among middle-class white America, to keep it going. Because remember, by 1970, middle-class white America had good jobs, great benefits, retirement plans. You know, if you were a middle-class white American worker in the 1970s, you would be retiring with a pension, with your own employer-provided health insurance, plus Social Security, plus Medicare. And at that point, if we were to continue to develop as a social democracy, it didn't mean more benefits for you. It meant more benefits for someone else. And I think that was really the juncture for America, when we didn't say everybody's a citizen, not just white middle-class people, but everybody's an American. Everybody needs health care. Everybody needs a good job. Everybody needs a good education.
Well, of course, it's very uncomfortable to ask an American, what is your birthright? When you listed what the average Australian gets in terms of simply being born there, in terms of government services, etc., it's pretty hard to come up with anything on this side of the Pacific.
Right.
And it is a little embarrassing. It's not a question that's asked.
You're not just an Australian. An Australian, a British person, a French person, a Swedish person, a German person, an Austrian person, a Finnish person, all of them take for granted things that Americans simply don't expect from their government.
Well, I think in a large part, a lot of Americans simply don't know. They don't know how the people next door in Canada are much better off. I mean, there is a willful ignorance, and Fox News and Rupert Murdoch, the export from Australia, has really, I think, done a masterful job in dumbing down the electorate. And, you know, you could be cynical and say, well, that's how the Republicans, have at least a chance at a majority by keeping their voters ignorant.
Well, yeah, not just ignorant, but keeping voters at home. I think on your show yesterday, you were talking about the 2010 election as a moment in U.S. politics when, the Democratic majority that was formed in the 2008 election fell apart. But the reality is, in the 2010 election, the same people who voted Republican still voted Republican. The difference was that many people who came out to vote Democratic in 2008 didn't vote in 2010.
Half of them, about.
And what people... Yeah. I don't have off the top of my head the turnout numbers.
76 million as opposed to 140 million. So
exactly. You have your fingertips the turnout numbers. Fabulous. Yeah. And it's, you know, this is the difference, right? In America, the turnout is low, but the turnout is especially low among those groups who would benefit most from social democracy. And that's no coincidence. It's not that people are dumb or people are lazy. In the United States, Election Day is... what day?
Tuesday.
Work day.
Right.
Well, if you work for $10 an hour in a country where you're not allowed to take personal days without permission, where if you don't work today, you don't get paid today, can you afford to take Election Day off? You know, that might be a problem for you. If you are black and live in Ohio, where you see there may be, in the 2008 election, there were lines, the New York Times reported, I think, up to 11 hours long. Now, you or I have probably never waited 11 hours in line to vote. Most people don't have that amount of time or dedication to be able to wait in line 11 hours. What if you have to go to the bathroom? You know, how do you wait in line 11 hours to vote? So it's no coincidence that turnout is low among the very groups that would support social democracy. The American political parties, especially the Republican Party, have tried to keep it that way.
We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Salvatore Babones in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah. age old song about the home of the brave and the land you run the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And returning now to the conversation with Salvatore Barbonis, who is joining us from Sydney, Australia. He's a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, Australia, and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He has an article at Truthout, "There Is No American Left." And picking up on the 1968 moment in the, at the Democratic Convention, which you cite as the as a pivotal moment in recent American history in terms of the demise of the American left. My understanding, and a lot of people have cited the Bill Clinton era as being a pivotal moment where the Democratic Party pivoted away from its traditional financial base, which were the unions, because the unions have been, over the decades, have lost their influence and clout, and they're down to about 7 or 6% now of the private workforce is unionized, and that Clinton pivoted towards Wall Street, and that was the cause of the corporatization, if you will, of the Democratic Party, where you essentially have the Republican Party, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, and the Democratic Party, who are kind of rented out by corporate America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Clinton administration certainly is part of that trend, and I think is maybe you know, one of the worst parts of that trend of the Democratic Party selling out to money interests. But it's not just in America, right? So there's been what's called New Labour in the United Kingdom, in Australia, in New Zealand, essentially throughout the English-speaking world, where the more liberal parties, the Democrats in the United States, the Labour Party in the UK and in Australia, have changed from being parties of workers and of unions to being parties of financial interests and seeking large corporate, you know, large-scale corporate backing. And that happened across the English-speaking world, not just in the United States. I think Bill Clinton and New Labour, Tony Blair in the UK, learned a lot from the Australian experience, which predated theirs.
With Bob Hawke, you mean?
Yes, yeah, in Australia, and the same remaking of left parties as, well, they called it moving to the center. I would call it moving to the right or moving in a corporate direction. But this is just part of a larger trend. I mean, I think that the money in politics comes first and the selling out comes second. My own academic research is on inequality and levels of income inequality in society. And one example I like to give is that, you know, if a corporate lawyer makes 20% more than a public interest lawyer, and you're coming out of a top law school, you know, you're a true believer, you're dedicated in what you do, are you willing to sacrifice 20% of your salary to be a public interest lawyer? Well, you know, that's a tough decision to make. I mean, 20% of your salary, that's a lot of money. But if you really believe in it, you do it. Well, today, if a corporate lawyer is making five times what a public interest lawyer is making, and you come out of a top law school with enormous debts because law school is much more expensive now, do you want a salary that's five times as much? Or do you want to work in the public interest? The temptation is much more to take the big salary. And that's not just with lawyers. That's all across the spectrum. So you're a politician, and there is a $500 campaign contribution on the table if you will support a policy. Well, can you afford to alienate your backers and lose $500? Yes, you can make the tough decision to do what's right and give up a $500 corporate contribution. Well, when that corporate contribution is $5 million, or you know, bundled together $50 million of contributions from dozens of people who a corporate CEO bundler has put together for you, it's much harder to say no. And I think that the money in politics and the money in society have really corrupted our political process. So I don't think Bill Clinton is a bad person. I don't think Bill Clinton, you know, came to Washington and said, I'm going to ruin things. I think Bill Clinton came to Washington at a time when times were changing. After the Reagan administration, after the 1980s, America was a much more unequal place than it had been before. Ronald Reagan, despite having been a union president himself, many people don't realize Ronald Reagan is the only president of the United States who came up through the ranks of being a union president first. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild. One of his first acts in office was to bust the Air Traffic Controllers Union. when there was the air traffic controller strike in 1981. By the end of the 1980s, and the Ronald Reagan and the George Bush 1 administrations, the union political backing didn't mean as much. Unions were not as rich as they were. They had fewer members. They didn't make as much money. And the same might be said in general. All of us who were non-corporate, non-CEO campaign contributors had much less to give. By 1992 or 1996, if you wanted to raise money to become president, you did it in corporate circles. And Bill Clinton was just part of that trend. I don't think he started the trend. I don't mean to let him off the hook.
No, but the same applies to, Barack Obama.
Exactly.
You just can't even get into the race nowadays unless you have money. Salvatore Bobone, it brings you to the question is, it's pretty obvious. If you make a political system about money, he who has the most money controls the system. So how did it get to that point where money controlled our politics and became the real issue? And we know that the media in this country is the main beneficiary of this corrupt system, because all the money that these politicians raise from the special interest to sell out the average American in order to get themselves reelected, that money, most of it is transferred directly to the television oligopolies in the form of buying television ads so that they can beat the opponents into oblivion and saturate the airwaves. And that's how they get...
And let's not forget there's the money after the fact that the president doesn't usually step down and become rich, but representatives and senators, people do 2 or 4 years in the House of Representatives, step down and become lobbyists for $800,000 a year. So there's money up front and there's a payoff at the end. Look, the danger is that if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I'm a sociologist who studies inequality. So every problem looks like inequality to me. So I admit I may be not the fairest person to ask. But if you ask me, it comes down to rising inequality. Inequality started to rise dramatically in America right around 1970, and it's risen unbelievably since then. I mean, median wages have been stagnant, haven't changed at all. The average American makes no more today in real terms than he or she did in 1970, yet very wealthy Americans make incredibly more. I mean, the economy has doubled in size with no increase in wages. And what that's done is it's put more money into politics because people have more money to spend. In the 1960s, when a CEO quite literally only made 8 or 10 times as much as a production worker, well, it's a lot of money. I mean, if you went to the CEO of General Motors or Ford, who in today's terms would have only been making maybe $700,000 or $800,000 a year, and I say only because, as you know, CEOs today make $50 or $60 million a year. If you were only making $700,000 a year and someone wanted you to make a $500,000 campaign donation, well, that's a lot of money to you. Now, today, if you make $10 million a year and you're asked to write checks totaling $500,000 for politicians to get your way, well, that may be worth the price. Right? So I think the corruption of politics, the money in politics, really comes down to the fact that there are more rich people. Far more rich people than there were in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And you can see the same in other countries. Other countries have had their wealthy people. The UK has had, landed aristocracy and the City of London, investment bankers. But the gap between those people and ordinary people in Britain didn't really start to rise until the 1970s, and especially in the 1980s, same time as it did in the US. And as a result, money in politics became a serious problem, starting in the 1970s and 80s. And it's actually easier to see this in the UK, in Great Britain, than it is in the US. In the US, we aren't members of a political party. I don't join the Democratic Party or join the Republican Party. I may register for them, but I don't pay a fee. In other countries, like the UK, people actually join a party, pay money to become a member and get a membership card of the party. Parties used to rely in the UK on membership fees for a large part of their elections. How did you finance an election? Your members paid for it, and you had 1 million members. Today in the UK, you don't have 1 million members per party. You have 100,000 or so members per party, and the elections are paid for by big money. And it's become the same in the US. It's harder for us to see, but the ordinary Democrat doesn't give $2,000 to the Democratic Campaign Committee. The ordinary Democrat doesn't give anything. A few Democrats get $50. The Obama administration, when it was soliciting, the Obama campaign in 2008, when it was soliciting donations, sent out a flyer to me saying, "We especially need donations," and there was a little box with an asterisk next to it saying donations especially needed at this level, and they were $50. The Republican Party also sent me the pre-McCain campaign, the Republican National Committee that before McCain was nominated, sent me a flyer saying we especially need donations, and the $1,000 box was checked with a little asterisk next to it. Donations especially needed at this level. So, you know, what's happened is that Republicans actually expect someone to sit down and write a $1,000 check to the party. 40 years ago, that would have been inconceivable. Who could write a $1,000 check? Today, tens of thousands of bankers, lawyers, you know, people in the finance industry, CEOs, top-level executives, tens of thousands of them can sit down and write a $1,000 or $2,000 check. It's the same as buying dinner.
In a broad sense, what I'm hearing from you, Salvatore Bombonis, is that America changed in the 1970s, and it changed in a way that the American dream was only reserved for the white majority who's now becoming the minority. And that since then we've had a kind of growing underclass, and we've had a party, the Republican Party, that's becoming increasingly, angry old white men and women, and a Democratic Party that's getting more pluralistic. But we've also developed a kind of underclass. So is it really, really about race? In other words, that the American dream simply ended because for a lot of people, because simply the white majority did not want to share America with the emerging underclass?
I think we didn't want to share it, and that was our big mistake. I don't think it was necessarily overt racism. The problem wasn't that white Americans said, we don't like you, you can't be part of the club. I think it was more the problem that once white Americans had all those benefits, I mean, if you look at a typical white factory worker, I'm not talking a university-educated person, a lawyer, a doctor, a university professor, an average white factory worker in 1970, in today's money, if we adjust for inflation, would have been making $20 or $25 an hour, would have owned a home, could have, you know, have no problem affording a mortgage, might have a second home, might have a boat, had full health insurance, because that person would have had a not an HMO like today, but would have had a full reimbursement employer-provided health insurance plan, had paid sick days, paid vacation days, because that person would have had a union contract, would have been covered by a union negotiated contract that provided these kind of benefits. You know, for this person, social democracy is not the top priority in life. Right? It's simply not on that person, and let me say that man, because really it's men who had these benefits. Women were excluded from them and only got them if they were married to a man who had these benefits. But a typical man or family that had these benefits simply didn't need to be politically active. Right? I think they went to sleep. And going to sleep at that point really cost them. Because over the next 40 years, that same factory worker today is now making $10 an hour with no benefits, no health insurance, no retirement plan. It's turned out to be a tragedy for that person. But we live for the moment. We don't live for 40 years from now.
Well, I think also what changed a bit later, changed under Reagan, was, and we know that American wages have not gone up since the late 70s at the end of Carter. And I think one of the reasons why is that under Reagan, and particularly his choice for the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who made credit so cheap.
Paul Volcker, yeah.
But he was succeeded in 87 by Greenspan.
Okay, yeah.
And Greenspan was the one that really made the cost of borrowing to banks so low so that they were able to get the American workers and middle class hooked on credit. So that would give them the illusion that their standard of living was commensurate with the fact that their wages weren't going up. And now you have an entire country enslaved by credit, the banks get the money at what, almost 0% now, and they lend it back at 20%. It's a hell of a deal.
Oh, sure. But I think credit is the symptom, not the cause. I mean, one of a fellow Australian here teaches at the University of Western Sydney, Steve Keane, is an economist who's very well known for arguing this, the credit bubble argument about how governments have kept people complacent and kept consumption up. But that's not really the issue to me. I mean, the problem is that wages haven't risen. Now you're right that as wages stagnated, cheap credit came available from the Federal Reserve and through changes in the system to lull people into a sense of complacency about that. But wages haven't increased since 1972. It's so shocking, it's unbelievable. But it's true that the average American, the median American person receiving a paycheck in 2011 or 2012 made less than the median American receiving a paycheck in 1972. It's even worse than that. If you adjust for age, the median American makes less today. I mean, the typical 25 to 35-year-old today makes 20% less than the typical 25 to 35-year-old did in 1972, once you adjust for inflation. Now, that's mind-boggling. Right now, cheap credit kept things going for a while. Women joining the workforce kept things going for a while. Women's labor force participation rose dramatically between 1970 and 2000. It's leveled out since 2000. There's been no real change there since then. But what's happened since wage stagnation started, we've had more credit, we've had more women going to work, but the key problem is the wage stagnation. Right? The key problem is the inequality. Ordinary people have had no breaks, and the very rich have gotten all the breaks. They make more, and they pay less in taxes than ever before.
So again, then, and we're getting towards the end here, Salvatore Barbonis, in the broader global capitalist economy, there's no question that capital has been the beneficiary of improved productivity, and labor has not, and that's a global problem. And again, the trend started to disappear. Household income tracked fairly consistently with productivity, and then suddenly the gains went up for capital and down for labor. So this is an extra. It's happening both globally and locally, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It started in America and spread to the rest of the world, but it's certainly been happening globally. And I think that comes before the political problem. Right. So we started this discussion with a question of why is there no American left? I think fundamentally it has to do with these changes in the economy that have underlined the viability of progressive viewpoints in politics in America and now in other places. I mean, the UK is dismantling its universal health insurance after 60 years of success. Australia is starting to dismantle its universal health insurance. We're infecting other countries with austerity politics. In Spain, Greece, and Portugal, policy changes have dramatically reduced the benefits for ordinary people, dramatically reduced wages, while improving the benefits for capitalists and for corporations. But I think the inequality comes first, the politics comes second. Right? It's the inequality that's made it possible for rich people to buy out politics. Let me put this in perspective. I mean, we all know that America was not very democratic in the 1960s. By that I mean women were excluded, blacks were excluded, there were no presidential primaries. Decisions were literally made by old men in smoke-filled rooms, both by the Democrats and by the Republicans. Yet those old men patriarchs in, rich old white men in smoke-filled rooms gave us more progressive politics than we have today. That's remarkable. The reason is the environment they operated in was different. They didn't have the ability to just take the way the pro-corporate parties have today. And that's going to be a long uphill struggle to reverse.
Well, Salvatore Barbonis, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'd love to continue the conversation. I hope we have a subsequent one. It's been fascinating, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Salvatore Barbonis, who's a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney in Australia. He is an associate fellow also at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he has an article at Truthout called "There Is No American Left." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with David Halperin.
Yeah. time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian, and Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you, David. And just in general terms, this embarrassing display of a broken government and a government that's going broke is beyond belief. I mean, what's your reaction to the absurdity of those congresspeople who simply can't say yes, can't make a deal, and can't do their job?
It's absurdity. It's paralysis. Blame belongs on all sides, not just Congress, but in the executive branch. But I would have to say that there is no equivalence. I think the Republican Party has left America as a matter of policy. They're extremely far right wing, protecting corporations and also protecting the wealthiest people. Their obsession with ensuring a tax break for the people who need it the least seems to make, at a time when they say we need to raise revenues, seems to me completely absurd. But they've also left America as a matter of responsibility. They're completely irresponsible. Taking something like the debt ceiling, I know they want smaller government, but the fact is that our government is in crisis if we cannot meet our obligations. And to use that as leverage to get what they want, saying we're going to act crazy and irresponsibly unless you give us what I want, it just shows that they have no more common sense, no more loyalty to America, and it's all just for them about politics and rewarding their cronies. And I just have no more patience with the party. And when I was a young man growing up, the Republicans had responsible people. They have very few of them anymore. The ones who try to be responsible are simply undercut by the most extreme members of the party.
Well, David Halperin, though, it would seem that they have been rewarded for their tantrums. Recall that it was a Tea Party tantrum that led to the first threat to the full faith and credit of the United States when they threatened to shut down the government over the debt ceiling. And that led to this sequester, which has in turn led to this so-called fiscal cliff. In effect, they won that round. And I'm not surprised that they're trying the same thing again. The president, in his talk with David Gregory last Sunday, suggested that, you know, that was one of the worst moments in his presidency. But he also suggested that the press is not being even-handed, and they weren't back then. If you recall, back then, when the Tea Party had their tantrum and threatened to shut the entire government down unless they got their way, the press were treating it as a he said, she said, a pox on both their houses.
Much of the press did that. And really, we need to be more aggressive. And not the press needs to stop saying, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand. They need to be unafraid to call it as they actually see it and not worry about being accused of being too liberal or too conservative. In this case, conservative tantrums and conservative opportunism and outrageousness is destroying our system. Now, the president has had a bad tendency in the past to negotiate with himself, to make concessions before the other side has made any, and we've seen a little of that again. And I think the president isn't totally powerful here because, in fact, the American people elected a Republican House. Part of that was because of skilled gerrymandering done because the American people elected Republican state houses in the states that drew the boundaries for congressional elections. But the fact is Republicans control the House. They have power. They have political power. And the president cannot steamroll over that. So the president can try to, you know, use gamesmanship and appeal to the American people. But in the end, Republicans control a lot of the government, and they need to step up and behave responsibly. And it doesn't serve conservative values, progressive values, or American values to continue to hold the government hostage in this extreme way. I respect they believe government should be smaller, spending should be less. But when you really pin them down, they can't tell you really how they could cut government so much that they could get their deficit reduction and have the tax cuts, even for the super rich, that they claim that they want. So their whole game is both irresponsible and premised on a pack of lies. And I'm tired of trying to be even-handed about this. I did work for many years for a nonpartisan organization where we tried not to hit the Republicans too hard, you know, even when the truth compelled it, because we didn't want to sound partisan. Now I'm on my own. I can say whatever I want. And I say that the Republican Party has left America and is ruining the country.
So, David Halpern, how much is this undercurrent of the Grover Norquist notion that they want to shrink government down to the size where they can drown it in a bathtub, and then and this libertarian notion of less government, laissez-faire capitalism? How much are they prepared to wreck the government because they simply don't believe in government?
Well, they are and they aren't, because then if their constituents say, you know, we didn't get our Social Security checks, or their constituents say, you know, you didn't invest in the businesses in our area, then they may go running from that. There's only a few that are really so pure. So part of it is just, you know, they're somewhat torn between their constituents and their sense of what actually is rational, and they're kind of rah-rah. We remember, you know, being in the College Republicans or the Young America Foundation, and we enjoy the idea of drowning government in the bathtub. Grover Norquist himself is a lobbyist for interests that sometimes depend on government to make them rich. And Mitt Romney was in business with people who, you know, they made money off government programs like for-profit colleges, nursing homes, and the like. So it is a whole mess of hypocrisy and lunacy in the whole thing. Again, I respect the idea that they say government is too big, and there are certainly examples of that. But in the end, their math doesn't add up. The things they claim they're for don't add up to deficit reduction. They add up to deficit increase, and we saw that under George W. Bush. He was a conservative president. He increased spending. He cut taxes, and we ended up with massive surpluses under Clinton, massive deficits under Bush, and a difficult situation where we're in recession, and it normally would call for, you know, spending to try to stimulate the economy, and yet our deficit was so bad that there was just a terrible series of choices. But those were forced by a GOP philosophy that is internally inconsistent, pulling in different directions, and makes no sense.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. What then can be done to counteract this kind of the one thing that you have to give the Tea Party credit for is that they have captured legislative power. They're not like the Occupy movement on the left that don't believe in electoral politics and are a protest movement that doesn't want to translate into a political movement, whereas the Tea Party is clearly, if they had any grassroots at all, they'd become an astroturf organization.
Yep.
And they've managed to basically intimidate the Republicans. As you mentioned, David, moderate Republicans are scared to death of them.
Well, President Obama was elected by, you know, pretty decisive margin. And he's not the left, but he's at least responsible, loves the country, has progressive values, and has, you know, pretty strong constituency. The Democrats won the Senate. Tea Party candidates who beat people like Dick Lugar lost statewide because they were judged as too extreme. So I think there isn't a strong left in this country. There are strong voices on the left, strong ideas, but a genuine progressive left is just not that politically powerful a force. But I do think something resembling the center, maybe it resembles Richard Nixon when he was president, but we have moved to the right, but something that is not Tea Party crazy on domestic and foreign policy, I think is kind of holding sway right now in the country, and that is the balance to the madness. And that's, you know, as a progressive and someone who truly believes in, you know, that things like excessive government surveillance that the Obama administration has, you know, continued to pursue is a bad idea. And someone who does believe that we shouldn't raise the retirement age for Social Security because people who do manual labor and lift things and everything else need benefits soon, right? You know, it doesn't apply to lawyers and bankers and people like that who didn't lift anything, or people like me. So I do believe that there ought to be a stronger left and more strongly, decisively progressive values that hold sway in Washington. But I do think right now, at least, there's a sensible and reasonable sort of moderate position that counters the Tea Party. And the Tea Party itself, as you said, is an astroturf thing, and that is, for better or for worse, I don't know which. Some of the grassroots impulses were bigoted and irresponsible. But, you know, then it got co-opted by people like Dick Armey. And if you read an article in the Washington Post last week, you know, he came in with an armed guard to take over the main Tea Party organization, Freedom Works, and then, you know, was then deposed. The big donor bought him out. So the Tea Party is just a mess of intrigue and special interests leading to God knows what at this point. So hopefully it's something that will fall of its own weight.
Well, but in terms of foreign policy, which you alluded to, David Halpern, they did do some damage with the embarrassing the non-passage of a treaty based upon the Americans with Disability Act. You know, the United States should have been proud of the fact that the rest of the world wanted to model a UN treaty on something that succeeded in America, and yet the know-nothings came out of the woodwork in spite of Bob Dole being wheeled into the chamber by his wife, who's also a former senator, the homeschoolers who somehow conflated the rights for the disabled with homeschooling managed to shut down that treaty. So they're not without their ability to not just screw up domestic policy, but also screw up foreign policy.
You're absolutely right. It's absolute madness. And you had something like, you know, Susan Rice, you know, that's not really a Tea Party thing, but just a basic Republicans trying to score political points and hurt the president at the expense of a common sense debate, whether you like Susan Rice or not. I like her a lot. I've known her for many years. What she ultimately, the stated reason for her not being eligible to be Secretary of State was completely ridiculous, that she repeated talking points that anyone in the administration could have read. It was just pure opportunism. Let's sting Obama.
Well, we have a strange situation now, of course, with the president of Venezuela is on his deathbed in Cuba, and Hillary Clinton is in hospital. And
yeah.
One of the things that the Republicans tried to suggest was that her concussion, Fox News was suggesting that her concussion was faked so that she'd avoid testifying.
She wouldn't have to testify.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
such crap. And, you know, to do that to Hillary Clinton, I know Hillary Clinton. I've had an opportunity to work with her, and she is incredible. I wasn't a fan of her presidential campaign. I supported Obama. But there is nobody who's harder working, smarter, and more committed to this country, whether you agree with her on every issue or not. And the idea that she would be trying to dodge responsibility is crap, and it turned out to be crap, if I may say the word crap on your show.
Well,
she's in serious condition. I hope she recovers quickly.
So let's turn to as since it's the end of the year and the beginning of a new year, David Halpern. Obviously, there's that ritual of in journalism of the you know the worst and the best and all the best of the worst of and all that nonsense. But in terms of the least reported story, to my mind, I cannot get over how little traction Bob Woodward, who after all is a big name in journalism, got from uncovering that tape of Fox News soliciting General Petraeus to become president of the United States, which the Washington Post buried in the style section. His former partner in Watergate, Carl Bernstein, wrote an article in The Guardian, you know, just tearing his hair out as to why this got no traction. I covered it as best I could and played the tape on the air. It's pretty extraordinary. The tape itself is beyond belief. But it's so clear that Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes are trying to be the kingmakers. That you know, they might have succeeded had Petraeus not been offered the CIA job, which he was shortly after this tape was made.
Yep, I mean, I think it's a great story. It doesn't really surprise me much. I mean, Roger Ailes started Fox News to to do something that I, you know, admire the impulse. He started it to change America. And yes, there's a certain hypocrisy in them pretending to be a news organization, but they're, you know, in some ways they're an advocacy organization. It doesn't bother me as much as it does some people on the left. We know what they are. They clearly every day are trying to help the Republican Party and help the conservative movement. And so they do a little behind the scenes doing that too. I think it's a really fascinating story because it shows who they are. But to me, it's not. It really isn't particularly surprising. And if the other thing that I noticed from the tape is that General Petraeus clearly talked on the tape as if he thought someday there was a possibility somebody would hear the tape. He was very hedged. He was being polite to Ailes and respecting Mr. Murdoch, but he was saying, "I don't want to be president." I think that if the tape was off, he might have said something different, but that's just my speculation. But I think Fox News has been a pernicious force in America because they've advocated such terrible values. But I don't think they've really hidden who they are. They have news shows. They have commentary shows. They have an absurd program in the morning called Fox and Friends that pretends to be a news show that's actually complete propaganda. But we all see through it. And if Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Ailes want to participate in the political process and use their money to do it, I think, you know, then the best thing we can throw at them are our own ideas and reasons why their vision is bad and their methods are corrupt. But I think a fascinating story, but not the most egregious thing I've seen all year. I've seen worse.
Well, I wouldn't suggest it was the most egregious thing, but what troubles me is that there's no outrage, there's no sanctions against the kind of behavior that Fox, not Fox, but News Corp were involved in England, which was beyond belief. How much they corrupted a government, they corrupted the famous British police force, they destroyed the lives of parents whose child was kidnapped and abused, these grieving parents by deleting
the voicemail messages.
I mean, things that you'd think that the public would be outraged about, and yet, just in the context of what we're talking about with this tape of Bob Woodward's, where they offered the presidency to Petraeus, I mean, in terms of whether there's any moral outrage in this country, what's the FCC doing? The Federal Communications Commission, under a so-called Democrat, they're apparently going to reward Murdoch. And relieve, I'm trying to think of the word. Remove the cross ownership requirements. And perhaps Murdoch is going to end up owning the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, who've just come out of bankruptcy.
Right. Well, I think the stuff in England was a disgrace, and a British commission, I believe, found that Murdoch was unfit to own a news organization or whatever they said. The chairman of the FCC is a friend of mine, Julia Sinikowski. I would say the FCC has had a tradition of doing some good things for consumers and some often doing things that very much benefited media oligarchs. And then, of course, many chairmen of the FCC and senior staff of the FCC go on to work for the media oligarchs, or they come from working for the media oligarchs. So it is kind of an unfortunate situation where we're not seeing it use the powers that it was set up to engage in, and especially, you're right, when you have somebody like Murdoch, who is both engaged, his companies have engaged in questionable behavior, and who clearly are using their media companies for political and financial gain and corporate gain, that we ought to be a little tougher on things like cross-ownership in that regard, because the reason we're banning that is because we don't want the media completely saturated with opinions that go one way and opinions that secretly and quietly favor certain powerful interests and corporate interests. And the ultimate version of that is Rupert Murdoch, who both tries to, as you suggest, and Roger Ailes, manipulate the political process and manipulate the economic system to their benefit. And there needs to be at least transparency about that stuff. And I think in the end, it is important to have a diversity of voices, and the FCC ought to be there to empower multiple voices and not just let the same old people talk.
Well, just in closing, David Halpern, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, which is where you were expressing your disgust at the Republicans. I mean, clearly the fact that the Tea Party crazies are dominating the news and dominating the Republican Party is in part to do with Fox having poisoned the debate and made it far more strident and far more partisan. Not that I'm calling for the equivalent on the left. A lot of progressives have said we need a left-wing Rush Limbaugh. I think that's the worst idea I ever heard. One Rush Limbaugh was quite enough.
It would be entertaining.
Well, it's true. But, I mean, just in closing, what is your sense of how the playing field could be leveled with a more progressive input into our politics?
Well, I think we need people to step up and be leaders, and people should run for office and not say, I'm just going to sit around. And people, and unfortunately, it takes a lot of money to run for office, but you see some people that come that aren't coming from privileged backgrounds and the same old sons of politicians and daughters of politicians. You're seeing some people step up and say, I want to be a leader. You are seeing some new voices in the media. You do see some of the philanthropic sector is progressive, and they do fund interesting things. But it needs more leadership, more vision, more people like Van Jones that are smart, creative, and also have a little bit of a sense of humor about this stuff. And you need people to say every day in their lives, I'm going to take a little time to speak out, to give a little money, to organize. It needs leadership, and it needs grassroots. But it's never going to be as powerful as the other side because it's funded by the rich. For me, the enemy or the fault here is not just the phenomenon of the Tea Party. It is Fox News, and it is generally a Republican Party and conservative movement that either is funded by corporations and doesn't care about average people, or is so off and so out of the mainstream in terms of values that coming together. I mean, when I entered a contest was asked by a magazine what should be the new slogan of the Republican Party after 2006 or whenever they had lost the Congress, it's Republican Party, rich people and angry people coming together. And that's what it is, and it needs to change to responsible people, maybe with a slightly different philosophy, but people who really care about the country and want to take a slightly different approach to politics. If they behave responsibly, then you could have more balance and you could have more progress in this country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Jose Benavides and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.